It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Did the elections turn out just like you wanted them to?
that never happens.
Mostly. Not entirely. Never entirely happens.
All right. Well, what did happen that you can accurately report on?
Well, the biggest surprise of the night, I thought, was that 912 went down. And I thought that was tremendously good news. It was the first time that a tax revolt initiative in recent Washington history had not succeeded. And that was something. All the momentum had been initially on the side of the initiative. It got its required signatures in virtually record time, 400,000 of them. And had a lot of backing from conservative groups, and the anti-campaign was slow getting off the mark, but once it did, it raised a truckload of money, had wide backing from business and labor and the environmental movement and good government types. And I think particularly in the wake of Katrina, there was a public awareness that infrastructure is something we need to fund.
Yeah, I wasn't too surprised about 912 going down. And part of the reason is because I knew a lot of the support for the initiative had come from outside the most populous region in the state. I think the results of who voted for and against I-912 ought to be a signal to our local politicians. If you look at the counties where I-912 passed, mostly rural, mostly conservative, east of the mountains, a lot of them.
But,
and you looked at the places where it was voted down.
But it was nearly 50-50 in those rural counties. It was very close.
Yeah.
Which is a surprise.
Which is a surprise. And if you look at the places where it was voted down, it's largely the most populous regions in the Puget Sound area, Snohomish, King, and Pierce in particular. Now, that should send a really strong signal to the Regional Transportation Board, which has been sitting on its butt for several years, not doing anything. They came up with a plan to fund transportation improvements in the Tri-County area, Snohomish, King, and Pierce. But then they didn't put it on the ballot because they figured it would be voted down. The tax increase would be voted down. Those people should be looking at these results and saying, gosh, I guess people want transportation improvements.
Well, they've got to, because under the gas tax that was passed by the legislature, that money has to be matched by a regional transportation plan before January 2007.
Or you lose it.
So it's got to go on the ballot sometime in the next 12 months, and that's going to happen. We're going to see that in 2006.
Yeah.
All right, and then related to transportation, the monorail did not fare so well.
Yeah, the monorail basically got the same percentage that Al Runty did, kind of a shock, I thought. And the real question now is what happens to the property that gets sold off. And the city council put in a request to the monorail board this week to slow the process down. The monorail board is trying to shut down as quickly as it can. And the monorail board basically just told them to go jump, that, you know, you didn't support us, so we're not going to honor any of your requests, which is really unfortunate. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the city council did not kill the monorail. Greg Nichols did not kill the monorail. The voters didn't kill the monorail. Joel Horn did it. The monorail board did it. The poor oversight, the poor management did it. And, you know, this city can support a monorail. We voted four times in favor of it. It was the management that sunk it, and it was really unfortunate.
However, there's an opposing argument here, too.
Okay.
That there's $110 million debt on the monorail. And the land that was purchased in order to build the land that's been purchased so far in order to build the monorail could go a long ways towards retiring the debt on that. It would also free up some tax base for other transportation issues or other infrastructure improvement projects. So if that land is sold in an expeditious manner and then the debt paid down, then people won't be paying as much on their car, as much on the monorail tax. Monorail tax can be retired earlier, and then you can tax for other things.
Well, you're talking about delaying it a matter of a couple months so you can make land use decisions. I mean, I think that's reasonable. Because at this point, you know, they're just selling it to whoever comes along, which is, you know.
Well, no, I think they have a point. The city's saying don't sell the property, but the monorail board is saying, look, if you want the property, buy it like anybody else.
All right,
whatever. I'm not saying mm-hmm. the city should buy it. I'm saying the city should have a say over how it's used.
Yeah, except that that means then the city's talking about things like, let's let it sit for a while to see if we're going to build more transportation in the corridor, let's see if we can use it for parks or whatever. But that, again, that would means it would take a lot longer for the monorail debt to be paid down, and that's not what taxpayers have said with this vote. They basically said, look, it's gone on too long. We don't think we don't think it's viable anymore. Let's close the project down. That includes paying off the debt. So the monorail board has a point, even if they've done, even if they've made it in kind of a petulant manner.
All right. Other races that you see of significance?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, the county executive race. David Irons had been polling very close to Ron Sims, and in the end, Sims pulled away quite decisively. The real turning point in that race, and I think this is the first time this has happened, certainly in local history, was a story broken by a blog. David Goldstein at Horse's Ass broke the story of David Irons basically beating up his mother, and that and that really was a deciding point in the race. I heard that from so many people that were just mortified by that. It was really the first thing they had ever heard about Irons, other than that he was, you know, a Republican, sort of standard issue East Side Republican affair. And they were just mortified by it. And talking with Sims people in particular, their polling said the same thing, that was just a decisive thing. It didn't really have anything to do with what Sims stood for or did at all.
All right. The one thing that somewhat shocked me from the local races was actually in the port races, where Lawrence Malloy got trounced.
He got trounced in the primary, so that wasn't really a surprise. His campaign did not do very well for whatever reason. He was behind in fundraising badly, which, you know, isn't that much of a surprise against a pro-business candidate, but he didn't raise anywhere near the money that he raised in his original election bid in 2001. And for whatever reason, that coalition did not come together the way it came together in 2001. And it's a shame, because he was a very good port commissioner.
And then Pat Davis's race actually looked like it was fairly close. So.
Yeah, it was 52 to 48. Jack Jolly came very close to unseating her, which suggests that business as usual at the port is vulnerable with a strong candidate. But it didn't happen this year. It was a very strong pro-incumbent mood this year.
All right. Well, sticking with local before we jump to national, Capitol Hill, the Gay Pride Parade looks like it might be moving.
Yeah, I had a column on this in the Weekly a couple weeks ago. The Seattle Pride Committee, the volunteer community organization that runs the Gay Pride March every June, has been negotiating in secret with Seattle Center to move the march. They originally announced this as a done deal last summer, and there were enormous protests on Capitol Hill over this. There was a petition with about 8,000 signatures that was presented at a community meeting had all scores of people testifying against the move. A lot of people concerned about safety. People concerned that moving it out of its historic roots in the Capitol Hill neighborhood. People not seeing much meaning in marching downtown on a Sunday afternoon. They went ahead and did it anyway. One of the concerns in particular that was raised about this is the depoliticization and the corporatization of the Pride March. It's gotten bigger over the years. A lot of national sponsors have been drawn in, while local community groups have become actually less involved and less supportive of the Pride parade over the years. And, it's devolving into one big party at a time when gay rights nationally and to some extent statewide as well are under some assault. You're trying to get gay marriage to become a reality, for example, and there's a court case pending in Washington State Supreme Court right now that is going to break sometime in the next couple months that could go either way, and it's like it'd become a major issue again in 2006, and it's not the time to be dividing the community, and this is a very unpopular decision amongst a lot of people in the GLBT community.
All right.
There seems to be a real problem with accountability in the Pride Committee. It does not seem to be responsive to its constituents. It seems to be a very small, sort of overwhelmed group of volunteers that are all friends and roommates and that are kind of scratching each other's backs on this one.
Well, jumping from our Capitol Hill to the nation's Capitol Hill, they were very busy this week. cranking out lots of bills and proposals and crashing others.
Yeah, extremely busy. There was some good news on Capitol Hill this week and some bad news. Which do you want first?
Give me the bad news first. No, I don't want the good news first.
Well, I'll start with the bad news and then go to the good. How's that?
That works for me.
For some of the bad news, it's not final. There's still time to do something about it. So get your pencils and paper ready on this one. The first one was something that happened in the Senate this week, although the House would be likely to pass it too. So the Senate is going to be the real battleground. It was a last-minute amendment to a budget bill that Lindsey Graham of South Carolina passed on Thursday, just before the three-day holiday weekend, that basically overturns the Supreme Court decision of last year and suspends habeas corpus for the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and the other various pieces of the offshore gulag that the Bush administration is operating around the world. It would essentially end their legal recourse of any kind. No access to lawyers, no access to due process. It would moot all of the cases that are now pending in court, whereby prisoners are petitioning to find out why they're being held. You know, many of them from Afghanistan and other countries were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Even U.S. officials have acknowledged that a lot of people are there are innocent and have no intelligence value whatsoever. But they're simply being held, you know, incommunicado indefinitely. It's a really alarming precedent. Really very, very bad news. However, on Monday, Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico is intending to offer an amendment that would overturn the part of the Graham amendment that suspends the habeas corpus. So he and his allies in the Senate need all the support they can. So call Murray, call Cantwell. Tell them to support the Bingaman Amendment on Monday to restore rights to the Guantanamo Bay prisoners. That was one piece of bad news. Another piece of bad news was Ted Stevens reintroducing in the Senate a piece of legislation we thought we had killed in the House last month to introduce major oil tanker traffic to Puget Sound. This is something that was banned in 1977, I believe, 78, somewhere in there, by Warren Magnuson. There was a rider that was put on a bill in the House last month as a favor by a representative from Texas to BP, the oil processing plant for the giant for their plant up in Cherry Point. They're trying to fend off a lawsuit by environmentalists and civic groups, saying that the capacity at that plant exceeds the limits that Magnuson's ban puts on it. Stevens now wants to gut this, and he does this. He's doing this even though, as Joel Connolly rightly pointed out in his PI column on Friday, Stevens gets a tremendous amount of re-election backing from business interests in Washington State. So this again is something where Murray Cantwell and Patty Murray need to be encouraged to defend Puget Sound from oil tanker traffic, because that could be environmentally catastrophic for the Puget Sound. And then another piece of environmental bad news this week came over in the House as part of the budget bill there. On Thursday, the House where's the committee? This is,
I think, it's the House Resources Committee.
Yeah, it is the House Resources Committee. It is House Resources Committee. I was thinking there was another piece to that name, but there's not. But passed, and it'll go to the full House next week. A piece of legislation that would basically lead to the privatization of anywhere from 15 to 20 million acres of public lands, mostly in the West. A lot of national parks, monuments, national forests, BLM land, you name it. It's being done as an amendment to the 1872 mining law that basically gives mining companies rights to mineral resources of the West for pennies on the dollar. This would actually mandate the selling off of the land and calculated sale price of the land would not include any of the value of the mineral resources therein. So in addition to what it means for the land itself, it's a tremendous corporate welfare grab. It's basically a piece of legislation that was written by the National Mining Association.
So what it would do is it would allow mining companies to go in and put a claim on a land, pay pennies for it,
patenting.
And then turn around once they've extracted the resources, turn around and sell it to real estate developers for, you know, whatever price they could get. And the real estate developers then, you know, cut down any trees or do whatever environmental destruction hasn't already been done and turn it into, you know, shopping malls, Walmarts, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and there's a fair amount of public land in Washington State that this affects as well. So it's very much a, and this is part of an even more overarching Republican plan to rewrite the nation's environmental laws. There's a systematic review of those laws that's being undertaken by the House Resources Committee, and so we're going to be hearing more of these sorts of proposals in the next few months. So this is one of the first, and it's pretty bad.
That was attached to a budget bill, right?
Yeah, and it's going to a full vote next week,
which means the Democrats can't filibuster. Democrats can't filibuster any of the budget bills. They're immune to from that.
All right. And the good news?
The good news, first of all, ANWR is not going to be drilled. That was something of a shock. I thought that was a done deal.
No, it turns out the Republicans are divided in the House.
Yeah. And to his credit, Dave Ryker was one of the Republicans who jumped on that.
Yeah. Some of the so-called moderate Republicans, those who don't believe that we ought to just go for a completely free market, et cetera, and just destroy the environment wherever and whenever we want to, basically said, look, you know, this doesn't make sense. We wouldn't even be fueling the U.S. economy. You know, we wouldn't even be fueling the America's need for oil for even a year by drilling in ANWR.
It's more like 6 months, I think.
Yeah. So they deserted on that. They said, we're not going to vote for this necessary budget bill if it contains that provision. And so the Republican leadership had to drop the ANWR drilling out of the bill.
And then, so that happened, and then the leadership also had to drop the vote on the bill because of budget cuts.
Yeah, they've delayed the vote on the entire bill because the moderate Republicans, the Republican leadership, dropped the ANWR drilling provision and dropped there was another provision in there that they dropped out too that would have allowed drilling offshore in protected areas on the East Coast and the West Coast. So after dropping those off, they thought, oh, we've got the moderates on our side now, so we can pass this bill, right? And then they realized they didn't have enough votes because Republican moderates looked at it and said, the cuts to Medicare, to food stamps, and to Medicaid and
social services.
And other social services and student loans are far too steep. You know, we're trying to
$51 billion.
Yeah, we're trying to balance the budget on the backs of the poor, and we're not going to do that. Which I thought was an incredibly good thing to do by the moderate Republicans. However, they're not totally against such cuts. The Senate version of the bill, which is probably going to sail through the Senate, has similar cuts in there. They're just not as steep as the House bill.
And it's probably going to go up for a vote again next week once the Republicans try and get their ducks in order. A lot of what's going on here is you're seeing Republicans who have won close votes in the past due to the strong-arm tactics of Tom DeLay. He's not in a leadership position in the House anymore, and the Republicans are having difficulty getting that coalition together, particularly with President Bush's weakness and the White House weakness politically.
Right.
So this is a time when moderates are feeling emboldened and Democrats are feeling emboldened, and it's a time when grassroots activism can make a difference.
All right. Jumping over to some of the outcomes of the national election.
Yeah, one of the things that could be influencing the moderates in the House, the moderate Republicans in the House, is some of the outcomes of
fear, total fear,
of races around the country. I mean, the Democrats won the governor's mansion in Virginia, which was a total surprise to everyone, I think, including the Democrats themselves. Virginia is considered a conservative state, and when the governor of the state is a Democrat rather than a Republican, that's a little wake-up call for midterm elections in 2006.
Well, the incumbent was Democrat also.
Yeah.
But it was still a very close race.
It was a very strong running by the Republican in that race. A Democrat governor was also reelected in New Jersey. Arnold Schwarzenegger staked his political capital on four initiatives that he sponsored in California, one that would limit union dues for political purposes, one that would cap state spending, another one that would force public teachers to work longer before they get tenure, and the fourth one, most ominously, would have redrawn legislative districts. Well, the public in California came out and said, gosh, you know, we voted for you because you were Arnold, but we're going to vote against your initiatives because you're a Republican. And I think that that's a another wake-up call to the Republicans in the House, too. A lot of the moderates are saying, look, our next race could go either way. They could elect a conservative Democrat to replace us, so we're not going to go for some of these more extreme initiatives that the House leadership wants us to do.
All right. Anything else on the national ones?
No, let's move on.
All right. How about internationally? There's been some elections.
Yeah, there were other election. There's other election news going on around the world as well. Tony Blair's anti-terrorism bill went down in flames. The biggest centerpiece of that terrorism bill was he wanted the ability to hold anti-terror. He wanted the ability to hold terrorism suspects in jail for 90 days without charges. And members of his own party, of the Labor Party, deserted him in the House of Commons and voted against that bill. That was a major blow to Tony Blair.
And there's history here, because the British government had done similar things during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and there was a lot of bad history from that period.
Yeah, so people are not likely to forget that anytime soon. In addition, in Israel, the Labor Party in Israel is swinging further to the left as well. Shimon Peres, who has always been considered a bulletproof candidate, who was heading the Labor Party, he lost his election to a guy who is a labor leader and a socialist named Amir Peretz. He's also a member of Peace Now, a group of politicians and folks who want to see peaceful negotiations with the Palestinian people and a withdrawal from the West Bank. So there's been a shakeup going on around the world, not just here in the United States.
All right. Well, from there, let's jump over to then This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, folks will notice in their newspapers today George Bush's comments yesterday that critics of the war in Iraq are trying to rewrite history. Right. And really, I think it's because George Bush himself just doesn't know the history of how the war began. He cites, for example, in his little speech there, that the UN passed about a dozen resolutions against Iraq for its weapons of mass destruction, but refused to cite that those were passed in the 1990s before the inspectors went in and basically dismantled and destroyed Iraq's weapons of mass production programs. He also refuses to mention that the UN actually sat down, listened to Colin Powell's presentation before the start of the war, and nobody stepped up other than Britain stepped up and said, well, yeah, we agree with all of this. A lot of people listened to that evidence, that so-called evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. They shook their heads and they said, this is all you have? This is what you're trying to get us to go to war with Iraq over?
And this makes no sense.
And it makes no sense. That's right. And it's kind of interesting that right now the Democrats are finally getting on their high horse and saying, you know, we need to look at whether or not the Bush administration manipulated this intelligence. It's about 3.5 years too late for that.
Yeah. And it's not as though there's no history of this. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution, the Kuwaiti incubator story in 1990, presidents lie in order to get the nation to go to war. This is something we need to learn.
Yeah. And we should remember, too, that, you know, former UN inspectors, including Scott Ritter, were saying before the war that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Joseph Wilson was sent to Niger to check out the yellow cake uranium story, and he came back saying it was not true. And that was months before the war started. And, of course, now it turns out, we find out this week, that the Pentagon knew in February 2002, more than a year before the war started, that the man who told intelligence officers that Saddam Hussein was providing weapons training, including in weapons of mass destruction, and support to al-Qaeda, was a liar. This was excerpts from the Defense Intelligence Agency report dated February 2002 were leaked to the Washington Post and New York Times last Sunday and then posted on the website for Democratic Senator Carl Levine. He's the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee. So you can go visit his website and find out what that memo
L-E-V-I-N.
is. Yeah. Now, of course, the Bush administration knows that they're in the wrong, and they know that they need to kind of play down this investigation and these calls for looking into this, because this week they were hosting Ahmad Chalabi, a major architect of a lot of the false intel on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. And they did their best to try to keep a low profile for him. In an unusual step, the State Department barred reporters and photographers from recording Chalabi's visit with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. This is highly unusual, because cameras and the press are usually routinely invited in to record the beginning of Rice's meetings with different foreign dignitaries, but this time they were shut completely out. There are rumors, too, that Chalabi is being groomed by the Bush administration as their only hope for a secular prime minister in the upcoming December elections. This is since they tried Ayad Alawi last time, and he was roundly whipped in the January elections. It's pretty pitiful, but they ought to really be embarrassed by this. There were some other embarrassments in Iraq this week. I want to go over them very quickly. One was the assassination of a second defense lawyer in the Saddam Hussein legal team. The defense on his legal team now want. They're actually boycotting the court, and they want to move the trial to a neutral country. They have a point. The UN urged this at the beginning and was ignored by the Bush administration, and it really ought to be done. But the Iraqi government has said they want to go ahead, and they will actually appoint a whole new bunch of defense lawyers if this team doesn't step up and continue to become targets for kidnappers and assassins. Now, another embarrassment for the Bush administration is reports of ballot fraud in the key province of Nineveh during the October 15th vote, including voter intimidation and KDP, or Kurdish Party officials, busing Kurds into various towns in order to swamp the polls with a yes vote on the Constitution.
That's something you speculated about at the time.
Yeah, that's according to a U.S. military report dated October 15th to 19th that was leaked to the Interpress Wire Service. And I suggest people go to the Interpress Wire Service website and look for articles by Gareth Porter. He's been writing about this issue and writing very well. Italian state TV also showed a documentary this week entitled Fallujah, The Hidden Massacre, showing photos and film of bodies of Fallujah residents, including women and children, whose skin was dissolved or caramelized by the use of white phosphorus shells, which were dropped by U.S. troops. That's against the 1980 UN Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, which bans the use of napalm and white phosphorus against civilians. However, the U.S. admits that they use white phosphorus in order to illuminate their battlefields at night. It just so happens Fallujah was a city, and when you drop white phosphorus in a city, it ends up on the bodies of women and children and other civilians. The U.S. has never signed the treaty, but that hasn't stopped them from continuing to use napalm, they say it's not napalm. It's Mark 77 bombs, or MK 77 bombs. It is napalm, except instead of using gasoline, they use kerosene. And the U.S. has never denied that its troops used the MK 77 firebombs, particularly early on in the war.
And the irony of going to war because of the desire to prevent weapons of mass destruction should be lost on no one.
Yeah, and finally, after multiple offensive operations in Anbar province to try to stop foreign fighters from coming into Iraq, the U.S. has largely failed. They tried one more offensive again this week, Operation Steel Curtain, in three towns on the border. They dropped 500-pound bombs on Husseiba, Karabla, and Al-Qaim. Once again, residents were forced to either leave their homes or die inside their homes, either from the bombs from U.S. troops moving door-to-door and shooting whoever moved, and also from lack of food, fuel, medicine, water, and electricity, all of which were cut off by U.S. blockades of those towns. It's pretty clear that the U.S. is not seeing that foreign fighters are fueling the insurgency. What's fueling the insurgency are these incredibly bad, these incredibly horrible offensive operations carried on by the U.S. military itself.
All right. Well, talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, public libraries, any place you find free periodicals. You can also find us online at www.eatthestate.org. And Job's going to give you a phone number to call if you want to volunteer or have any questions or comments.
206-719-6947. And we'll get you to remember that phone number sooner or later.
Sometime.